Hello, it's Tom here. We've got a great episode of Last Orders for you today, but before we get into that, I just want to let you know about Spiked's very exciting new daily newsletter. It's called Today on Spiked. Sent out every day at 6 p.m, it gives you your essential roundup of all of the content that we've published that day, along with exclusive commentary from the Spiked team that you won't read elsewhere. And it is also completely 100% free. We're publishing more and more these days, so if you want to make sure that you never miss an article or an essay or a podcast, stop what you're doing right now and go to spiked-online.com/newsletters and sign up to Today on Spiked. Once again, that's spiked-online.com/newsletters and Today on Spiked. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is a show all about freedom and the nanny state, and for a while longer yet, it seems, COVID. In today's episode, we discuss vaccine passports, the Batley blasphemy row, and the future of the nanny state. Hello, and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor at Spiked. I'm joined today, as I am every month, by Chris Snowden, Director of Lifestyle Economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
And today we're delighted to be joined on the podcast by Claire Fox, a return guest on the show. Claire will be known to many of you, I'm sure. She's the Director of the Academy of Ideas. And since she was last on the podcast, has become an unaffiliated peer in the House of Lords and making plenty of waves there already. So, Claire, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Great to be here.
So the last time we had you on, Claire, was actually straight after the first national lockdown was announced. So we've learned so much since then about COVID, obviously, about civil liberties. We've gone through this pretty remarkable and horrendous experiment in the government taking away our liberties to give them back to us, only to rescind them again. So I just wanted to get both of your reflections, really, on what we've learned over the past 12 months as we mark this pretty grim anniversary. So, Claire, do you want to kick us off?
So we certainly know a lot more about coronavirus. And I think the more that we've learned, that should be knowledge is power. But actually, as we've learned more, it seems to me that some of the reactions and responses from officialdom haven't changed. And the most recent episode being that we will unlock based on data, not dates. But actually, we've got these firm dates that are firmly stuck, and it doesn't matter whether the data changes. So one of the things that I've learned is that despite the attempt at saying that our handling of the pandemic would be based on following the science, something which one might query is if that would be the only thing that you would do, actually there's been an obvious problem of them not following the science, even if that were to be the only thing that you were doing. What else have we learned? We've learned that the way that we understand liberty has changed completely, but it's not maybe something that we should be surprised by, because a lot of the trends were there pre-COVID. And I think this idea that you need permission to be free, that you wait to be given freedom, is one of the most dispiriting aspects of this, that to a certain extent, freedom is treated as a privilege to be handed out to you rather than something that you as an individual have possession of. And that fear is a great mechanism when it's deployed for people to say, I will give up my freedoms because I'm frightened, or rather maybe the notion of safetyism and safety is always the thing which clashes with freedom. And if you want, in this instance, safety is won, freedom is lost. I mean, my final reflection, just because I'm in a different situation, is I've been shocked by the parliamentary aspect of this. I've never really followed Westminster closely. I didn't expect to be where I am. But looking up close at the way legislation is brought in without scrutiny, without proper debate, the complete disregard for any notion that you might want to query any of the most egregious illiberal laws that have been brought in, and the way that you're treated as some kind of maverick, lunatic, you know, libertarian, sort of irresponsible, COVID denying, you know, et cetera, anti-science and all. That's just kind of widely accepted. And I've often found myself very isolated, that even the people who are more sceptical have suddenly found they've got something more important to do when a debate comes out at the Lords. You know, then I suddenly find I'm the only one there. Just one extraordinary thing to note was in the last coronavirus, you know, the renewal of the legislation, actually, there were loads of Lib Dems and indeed Labour and non-affiliated who all started criticising the government over the civil liberties issue. And I really did think, this is the first time you have ever said this, right? You have never, ever in the whole time I've been here uttered a word. So it's become slightly respectable to have a go at them over civil liberties. But they broadly coming from people who've accepted that the government should not be criticised, and anyone who does criticise the government is leading to a kind of anti-vax, irrational, you know, dissenting voices. And the demonisation of dissent has been a very dangerous aspect of what we've seen recently.
And Chris, what are your thoughts 12 months in?
I would be quite interested to listen to some of those old podcasts again. I seem to remember that one with Claire a year ago. I think we were fairly positive about government response, and we thought Whitty and Vallance seemed fairly credible people and they must know what they're doing. In a way, the whole thing has kind of been an illustration of populism. In a way, it's kind of shown that, you know, people have had enough of experts, and that's because the experts are so often wrong. I mean, wherever you stand on the lockdown policy and all the rest of it, there's just no denying that, well, the science went in a 180 degree turn back in March. And so no one's really kind of carrying the can for that. Yeah, the replacement for Public Health England is being headed by Jenny Harris, who was the personification of the, you know, masks don't work, we just got to squash the sombrero, and there's no point trying to suppress it, and travel bans don't work, and all this stuff that everyone's completely changed their mind about. And that, in fact, most people in the pub, if they were still open, would have said, well, these are obvious things to do. But the experts said the exact opposite, and then they changed their mind about it. And then you got the flip side of populism, which is once people stop believing in experts, they start believing in anything. And so you've had all sorts of crackpots coming up with, you know, various theories about, well, it goes all the way up to anti-vaxxing, doesn't it? But with the, you know, COVID's gone away, we've already got herd immunity and all this kind of stuff. And so the whole thing is just an ocean of nonsense, and no one seems to really know what they're doing. And I think it kind of illustrates some of the trends we've seen over the last 10 years or so, you know, of what is called populism, but really is just a declining faith in the powers that be. And people can see that these people don't really seem to know what they're doing.
Claire?
I just wanted to reflect one thing from that year ago when you were saying we were kind of quite positive about the government. It was a source of annoyance to me. It continues to be an annoyance to me that people play gotcha, right? And that we all noted, I think, the way the journalists, you know, it really was a case of if Jenny Harris or Boris or anyone said black, somebody else would say white. You know, it was kind of an irritating thing that you felt that anything that anyone said was just disbelieved. I don't know where that falls into your description, Chris, but that annoyed me because I wanted to take on good faith that the people who were running society were trying to resolve this situation and were not in bad faith. You know, I didn't think, and I've never thought, that this was a conspiracy to steal our liberties and so on and so forth. That is all, in my opinion, nonsense. But I think what's happened is that they became very defensive. The political elite became very defensive with Sage, which meant that any criticism became the same as being a crackpot criticism. And they have never conceded that any mistakes were made, which really creates a cynical atmosphere. Because, you know, it's fine to say we've changed our mind or we've looked at it again and we've decided this, but that never happened. It's like as though you're not allowed to query any of that. That bit has, I think, led to the growth of an unhelpful cynicism that I don't like. I do think that there's been a lashing out as well, a real attempt. That's why I'm saying the demonization, the attempt at saying that's misinformation, should be banned. All of that has just fueled this sense that you can't trust anyone. And I'm not saying we can't trust anyone, but they've contributed to that climate of not being able to distinguish between good faith, valid scientific advice or interventions, and this sense that you're not allowed to query the science. And the final thing is, this has really fueled the politicization of the issue, is that there has been an opportunistic use of the lockdown to bring in measures which have got nothing to do with coronavirus, you know, and so you do have this sort of enthusiastic low traffic zone areas and so on brought in by councils using COVID to bring in something which wasn't very popular locally, where there won't be any opposition. I am so fed up of Lord Bethel's his name, but the minister, you know, the Matt Hancock figure in the Lords, Lord Bethel, you know, he's a very nice guy and everything. But he keeps saying, well, one great thing about this is we've learned how important data sharing is and we can bring in all these new data things, you know, and he's like sort of like a puppy dog. You know, we've discovered this stuff on public health. We've discovered that obesity is the issue we need to tackle. We've discovered. So it's like, my God, you know, you wonder why people get worried about what you lot are up to. You're taking the coronavirus, which is a serious public health issue, and you're enthusiastically bringing in measures which have got nothing to do with coronavirus that you happen to want to bring in. And then you don't let anyone criticize you because then you say they want to kill granny and don't believe in coronavirus. So that, I think, has created this real mess politically.
And on that point of things that the government seem to be ushering in without much criticism, it feels like, I want to bring the conversation on to, as we look forward, what the new normal for now is going to look like. And a big part of this discussion is, of course, vaccine passports or vaccine certificates, even for domestic use. This is something which even a few weeks ago was something that Nadeem Zahawi and the government were pretty much categorically ruling out, saying it was un-British and discriminatory and we're not a papers please society. Now they seem more or less inevitable. So there's this consultation going on at the moment. The government has been issuing grants to various companies for some time now to develop the technology. And at this point, it does seem like we are going to get them in some way, shape or form, or at least that's the threat. So I just wanted to get both of your thoughts really on this particular policy. What do you make of it? How is it going to, if it does come in, rewire our relationship with the state and all the rest of it? But Chris, what are your thoughts on the domestic vaccine passports issue?
Well, I'm against it. I don't think it's necessary. I'm confused at what the timescale is going to be for this, because apparently it's not actually going to be ready in May when the pubs open, but it might be ready for Christmas. Well, I'm not anticipating any big problem by Christmas. I might be wrong. But if we did need it, and I don't think we do, but if we did need it, we'd need it in May. And it's not going to be around for then. So what's the point? And there are all sorts of problems with it. I mean, a lot of people have natural immunity because they've already had COVID. Yeah, they can get an antibody test, but, you know, it's a blood test, which seems to me quite a thing to ask just to get a pint in a pub. And they're not going to trust that test for very long. Yeah, I think this is fundamentally different to going abroad. You know, people go abroad once a year, you know, at most, in the case of most people. And other countries understandably want to have proof of vaccination. It's just a totally different kettle of fish in a pub, in a restaurant or what have you. I've seen today that the public opinion, as usual, is extremely authoritarian on this, and most people support it even to go to a pub. And as you say, it seems like the government's set on doing it. I mean, it requires the government to set up an app and handle data, which it's got a terrible track record of. There's no obvious endpoint to it. If we're still talking about this at Christmas time, are we still going to be talking about next summer, next Christmas? At what point do we just accept that the vaccines work? And that's the main point. Do the vaccines work or not? If you look at Israel, and I know they do have kind of a vaccine passport for certain mass gatherings in Israel, but, you know, everything's going so well in Israel. The hospitalizations and the cases are just plummeting. And there seems to be this idea that even though 90%+ of pensioners have got antibodies now, and presumably that means they have a very good level of immunity, that somehow the virus is still going to keep circulating really quite rapidly. The R is going to remain above one or go above one. And anybody who doesn't have 100% immunity is going to get it and possibly die. And that seems to be the basis for all these models suggesting that it's going to be 1,000 or more deaths a day in the middle of July. I'm not a virologist, but that doesn't ring true to me. Nothing about that seems to be familiar from other diseases, you know? So I really just think that we should trust the vaccines. The vaccine program's gone really well. The vaccines are really effective. So long as we keep hospitalizations and deaths down to a low figure, a figure probably above zero is realistic, but not disastrous. And that really should be the end of it. You know, I just I don't see it working because I don't trust the government to get it right. It's clearly discriminatory. It's going to be particularly discriminatory against young people because they're not going to have the vaccine. And what really annoyed me about this is that the government seems to be more or less openly saying it's doing this as a direct incentive, to put it kindly, basically coercion of younger people to get the vaccine. That's why they're doing it. They want to increase coverage of the vaccine. And the best way they think they can do that for the under 40s is to say, you're not going to have a social life unless you take that vaccine. Well, that is just, that's not a nudge. That is outright coercion, and everybody should be against it.
Claire, what are your thoughts on vaccine passports?
So I think it's fueling a real hostility to the vaccination program. It's so ironic. One of those things that they do without thinking about what they're doing. I agree with you, Chris, that, you know, either the vaccine's working, there's been a huge take up of those people who've been offered it so far. But I have noticed an increase in people being anti-vaccination the more this conversation's gone on, because they start saying, well, therefore the vaccines can't be working then. Right. So, I mean, how ridiculous is it that you have a government policy that, because they appear to be trying to coerce people to do something that they were probably going to do if they were offered the vaccine, makes it seem as though having the vaccine doesn't protect you, and you therefore get into this situation where all these precautionary measures are used to protect us despite the vaccine program. So it makes no sense whatsoever. Also, it reminds me of something like CRB checks, which is, it's a kind of, it also has that kind of feeling of, well, we won't force you to do it, but we're not going to stop you doing it. The government recommends you do it. Everybody will then think the way they prove that they're a safe venue is by doing it. When I say everyone's, you know, the tension is the places will think that they can prove some kind of virtue by bringing in these extraordinary measures. And it's not just a certification, it's extra testing, double masking, masks inside, you know, all these different things to prove that you're a kind of safe place. And I think that, just like with the CRB checks, where it was kind of like a disproportionate measure to deal with a very small issue in that instance that got out of hand. And even when the government said you don't need to do CRB checks, everyone carried on doing them anyway. I mean, this was kind of criminal checks against, to protect children from abusers by looking at their criminal records. You can see with all of these measures, once you've accepted a kind of precautionary principle approach in extremis, as the government seem to have done in many instances, there's no holding back to the kind of measures that you popularize that then, even when you try and lift them, don't get lifted. So a great example is the care home situation at the moment, where they've basically said, you can now visit care homes, one person can visit. I mean, it's the most measly granting of freedom, by the way. But nonetheless, most care homes won't do it because it's been left to them, and they're all going, oh, we'll still carry on doing this. We'll still have the glass in between you. We'll still won't let you do this. So I think that my greatest dread with this domestic vaccine passport is it encourages cynicism about vaccination in general. It embeds and institutionalizes this idea that we want total safety in all instances and guarantees that we're going to be safety, and we see each other as the problem. So it's like, have you got your certificate? Where's your certificate? Why don't trust you? You might be a carrier. That kind of misanthropic reaction. But ultimately, I don't think it'll work. So the point that Chris says is that, you know, talk about going through the motions. By the way, Nadeem Sahawi, I feel a bit sorry for him, because he said to me on Twitter, he guaranteed me it wouldn't come in on Twitter, promised. And he, every day he must get about 100 tweets copying me and saying, you promised Claire Fox, as though that somehow was anything important. But I don't think everything he said implies that he wants it. A lot of people don't seem to want it, but the government seem to all the time be going for the most risk-averse aspect of populism, which is accommodating to the most fearful by showing that they're prepared to do something. And in this instance, I think it's completely counterproductive. I don't want to fetishize it. I agree. Well, by the way, just on the international travel, I completely think it's a different question. But domestic certification to be able to be free is a broader problem. And this would, if it came through, set a precedent for certificates for everything, it seems to me.
And it is interesting as well, as you say, Claire, thinking back to CRB checks, there's obviously the identity cards debate of the new Labour years. Boris Johnson famously saying that if he was ever asked to produce one, he would eat it in front of the officer. How things change. Also, it's interesting that Tony Blair is hanging around the government and this policy in particular like a bit of a bad smell, speaking to Michael Gove recently and all the rest of it. But on that, Chris, do you think this is going to become that kind of new Labour era? Wasn't limited to them, but that kind of new Labour era authoritarianism, sort of surveillance stuff, is that going to be part of the new normal if we're not careful? Is that something which is going to outlast just the next year or so?
Yeah, for sure. If it happens, I'm still kind of skeptical about it happening, to be quite honest with you. It just seems such a mad idea, and it's going to knacker up pubs yet again. I guess that means maybe it's more likely to happen, seeing every government policy last year has had at least some angle of knackering up pubs. But yeah, if it doesn't come in the summer, and we're told that it won't do, unless we have a massive outbreak in the summer, where is really the demand going to be for it to suddenly come in November or whatever the planning? I just somehow think it will die a death. Maybe I'm being far too optimistic again, but it just seems so expensive and fraught with problems and bureaucratic and business destroying and ultimately unnecessary that hopefully it will be dropped at some point, or it'd be left to be a voluntary scheme, which was initially, you know, I say initially, like 2 weeks ago, that was the debate, wasn't it? The big debate, oh, Boris says that pubs might be allowed to bring in vaccine certification. And like literally 2 days later, it was suddenly announced it's going to be a government policy and everyone's going to have to do it. Maybe they'll go back to the voluntary thing. And if they go back to the voluntary thing, it won't last very long because it's really not in pubs' interest to be mucking about, turning away a certain proportion of, you know, their customers for the sake of something that has a negligible impact on risk.
I think what's really weird about it, I think it might be voluntary but encouraged. That's my kind of dread, because it's neither one way or another, right? And the point I'm making is that I think lots of venues are risk averse, and it might eventually dwindle out in the way you said, Chris, but it is funny what people don't think about, because I actually said to a friend, he's very keen on it, by the way, says, as long as we get our freedom back, I don't care, you know. And then he said, you know, I just, you know, I want to go to the pub and I'll show my vaccine passport. And then I said, yeah, but say you want to go with your son. And he said, what's that got to do with it? And I said, well, he's 21. He's not going to get the vaccine. You know, you can't go with your son then. He said, that's ridiculous. So it's a kind of funny conversation. I said, yes, but the thing is, he won't have had the vaccine and you're going to have to wait. And he said, well, he'll be all right because he's 21. I said, yeah, exactly. So the thing that's, it's almost like people say, it's a really good idea, but that's because they've had the vaccine and they've got their piece of paper without thinking about all the people who might not have it, right? And there are still quite a lot of people who don't want the vaccine, but it's not just don't want. What about the, you know, I want to get pregnant or I am pregnant or, you know, there are, you know, all this sort of thing. What are you going to do? How are you going to prove it? But I do think it sets, which is Tom's question, really, I think there's a normalization of this idea that you need to prove that you're safe. That's the bit I don't like. And I think that bit will linger. And that, in a way, is the most disappointing thing that will come from this, in a way, is this idea that we have to kind of, in order to be free, we have to prove that we're healthy. I mean, that's a terrible conclusion.
Even that idea of a freedom pass is such an Orwellian idea. It's like your freedom license or something like this. But I hope Chris's optimism will be panned out on this subject. Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. But let's move on to a very different issue relating to freedom, and this is Batley's blasphemy law, effectively. So this huge scandal around Batley Grammar School in Yorkshire, where a teacher at the school in a religious studies class had shown Muhammad cartoons to his students in a classroom discussion. Parents, as well as just other activists, it seems like, got wind of this. Some groups of Muslims protested outside of the school. It led to him being suspended. They're continuing to call for him to be sacked entirely. He's now had to go into police protection and hasn't been back to his home in a few days. Not only is there a concern about his life, but also his name has been released on the internet by various local activists and charities and so on. So it's really bringing back that discussion in the wake of the beheading of Samuel Paty in France, of this threat to freedom of speech from groups of campaigners, Islamist campaigners in particular, who seem to want to kind of usher in blasphemy law effectively via kind of mob aggression. We're seeing that in Britain in a very live way that we haven't for some time. So just to kick this off, Claire, first with you, what was your reaction to this particular story? Do you think we're entering a new phase of that particular debate?
God, it's so shocking, you know. I'm genuinely upset by this in a way that... And the reason I'm upset is not that the activists objected. I mean, you know, you might anticipate that. But the lack of solidarity with the teacher from so many people in positions that should know better. The local MP was ambivalent. Well, first of all, she congratulated the school for being responsible for suspending the teacher. She then slightly mediated her terms. The National Union Education Union spent days before it said anything. I mean, we haven't been able to shut them up through this pandemic, right? And all they've talked about is teachers' safety, the importance of teachers' safety. And here we have a teacher, in hiding for his life, and they don't say anything. And then they come up with some very mealy-mouthed statement yesterday, Kevin Courtney from the NEU, basically saying we must calm down for the sake of everyone and we care about our members in the Batley Grammar School. They haven't even identified the one teacher. So it's like everybody, you know, calm down. And I'm upset about it because I suppose it's the epitome and the culmination of the "I find that offensive, can silence people" played out in the real world and with some incredibly dangerous consequences. But the one thing that is slightly confusing is, on the one hand, I don't want in any way to look like I'm avoiding criticizing those members of the Muslim community who are at the extreme end saying you can't ever say anything that disrespects the Prophet Muhammad or show any pictures or any of this. And there is a real problem of activists, and particularly, you know, progressive activists, who imagine that if you criticize anything that anyone who's a Muslim says, that you're exhibiting Islamophobia. I don't want to shy away from that, but I was actually bemused by the radical Muslim activists of outside Batley Grammar School, who sounded like they'd been on some sort of woke safeguarding course when they explained why they were doing it. So they basically said, this is very damaging to the well-being of the pupils. It will undermine their self-esteem. And this is a safeguarding measure. You know, in other words, they used all the language that we associate with student union safe spaces to justify what they were doing. The Quran was not quoted once, but they did sound like they'd been on some course in how to protect young people from damaging images, or, you know, all the things we associate with free speech. I really would like every teacher in the country to use that particular textbook, the egregious textbook, and have a kind of day of solidarity of teaching the same thing. Every teacher do it, you know, everywhere, something like that. It's not that I want the government to interfere in this. I mean, it's not in straightforward, but you would just want some leadership, some very loud leadership. And Tom, your reference to Samuel Paty in Paris is so important because it's a parallel story and he was beheaded. So it's not like as though you're making a fuss. You know, stop making a fuss, Claire. People keep saying to me, I don't know why you're upset about this on social media. It's like, I don't know. Maybe it's because. But we know what's happened in France and before that, the whole Charlie Hebdo thing, that there is a life and death thing here. So when that teacher's in hiding, he's not being a kind of wimp. He's actually right to have some genuine fears. And therefore, you would want a disproportionately loud leadership coming from all political parties saying, we won't tolerate this. We won't stand for this. I don't want the Muslim activists to be rounded up and arrested. I don't want anything dramatic to happen. I just say, we don't care if you protest. We're teaching this anyway. Go away.
Definitely. And Chris, what are your thoughts on all this?
I think that when civilizations fail to stand up for their values, they ultimately die. And it's obviously very similar to the French case last year. but with two differences. One, this teacher hasn't been beheaded yet, at least. He's merely in hiding for his life. And the perhaps more important difference, even, is that in France, the government, and particularly Macron, were extremely robust in standing up and defending free speech. And that hasn't happened. Quite the opposite's happened. In fact, the response from the school was craven. They grovelled and apologised, suspended this teacher, and very little support from the Prime Minister or anybody in the government. And, you know, things like this have to be a red line, because being offended to the point of threatening to murder people because somebody has made a cartoon or a drawing of a historical figure is just not what Western civilization is about. And if we have a clash of civilizations here, then ultimately the response has to be, you know, if you can't tolerate this, you're going to have to go to a country which is more to your liking, because fundamentalist Islam is basically incompatible with Western civilization. It's not to say Islam per se is, but fundamentally Islam is incompatible with Western civilization. And no one knows that better than fundamentalist Muslims, because they've been attacking Western civilization for the last 40 years. So we have a clash of civilizations here, and somebody has to prevail. And we're not going to start bringing in blasphemy laws. We've only just got rid of our blasphemy laws. We have to stand up for free speech. And it's pathetic that so few people in the government in particular, but also in the school, have been brave enough to do that.
But the only thing is, Chris, you know, when you say return to a country where blasphemy is unacceptable, you might mean Scotland. I mean, one of the things that's difficult is that we are in a situation whereby, in order to be able to contrast, I agree with you, of course, you know, in order to be able to contrast, we stand up for these civilizational values. You know, you think you can come and say that, and you can't, because we believe in this. But actually, we've just seen a part of the UK introduce the most draconian hate crime legislation. I've watched and was sort of part of opposing a Conservative government under the cosh from a demonstration and a terrible murder of a young woman, bring in the precursor to a misogyny hate crime as an amendment to a domestic abuse bill in the House of Lords. I only say that because they basically had this amendment attached to something completely different, and the government folded. I was opposing it, supporting the government against it, and the government folded. So I ended up being the only one opposing it. And hate crime legislation, like the misogyny hate crime, counting of hate crime, is exactly what's given a green light. Why would people in Batley think that you could stand outside a school and say you're not allowed to teach that? That's Islamophobic. That's hate. They got that idea. That's what I'm saying, is they got that idea, not from the Quran, but from the climate around free speech. Now, I do understand that there are tenets of Islam that are inhospitable to Enlightenment values, but there are tenets of Catholicism that's like that. But because of the nature of the way anti-racism has developed over the years, there's been far too much of a confusion between Islam as a religion and racism directed at Muslims. And by the way, that exists. You know, look at my timeline sometimes. There's a lot of people who are anti-Muslim because they're Asian, you know what I mean? They say, kick them out. And, you know, I mean, there's a bit, that attitudes exist. I don't deny that. But it's minor in comparison with what is proclaimed. And we know that any attempt at debating this in relation to the terrorism of ISIS over recent years has been basically verboten, because we're told we'll be Islamophobic if we even have the conversation. So that's made it go underground. We all know that the grooming gang scandal was never and has never been properly discussed because of who the culprits were, and so on and so forth. So I just think it's kind of slightly more confusing than it just being the religion, but it's the fact that Western civilization itself has collapsed in on itself. And that gives space for that to grow.
I agree.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So let's move on to our final topic here, which is really the future of the nanny state after COVID. So I think a few of us could have been a little bit optimistic that going into this, when confronted with a genuine public health crisis, that might spark a bit of a reappraisal as to why all of these institutions, Public Health England, the World Health Organization, had spent all of their time up until this pandemic talking about vaping or biscuits or obesity, whatever it was, these lifestyle issues that they seem to be obsessed with. The question now is whether coming out of this, there is going to be that reappraisal, because if anything, evidence suggests things in Britain are heading in the other direction. We've had Boris Johnson, our previously allegedly libertarian prime minister, get very interested in healthy eating and exercise. There is this new body that's been set up, the Office for Health Promotion, which says it's going to lead national efforts to improve and level up the public's health around obesity, mental health, promoting physical activity, etc. So, Chris, where do you think we're headed at the moment? Has the pandemic bolstered the public health establishment, regardless of Public Health England folding and all the rest of it? Are we going to see more nannying, not less, in the years ahead?
I think, yeah, probably see more, because the Department of Health has never had more power than it has in the last year. You know, so you've had all these people from the Department of Health who've got their various nanny state agendas, and they've had the era of government, era of Boris Johnson, like they've never had before. We've now got this Office for Health Promotion, which is a splendidly old-fashioned name, isn't it? I quite like the fact that it is old-fashioned. And what I particularly like about it is it hasn't got the word public health in it. So we've now got, what's it called? The Health Security Agency, I think, is the infectious disease one. That was going to be called the National Institute for Health Protection, but it's been renamed even before it's been launched. So the Health Security Agency is going to be about biohazards and infectious disease and environmental hazards and genuine public health stuff. And the Office for Health Promotion is going to be the, you know, taking the sugar out of biscuits, telling people to eat their greens and not consume more than 14 units of alcohol a day. And at least, you know, people will know a bit more where they stand. You know, if it's the Office for Health Promotion trying to tell you to, you know, lead a healthier lifestyle, that's, you know, kind of fair enough. And if they run digital campaigns telling people to have their five a day, fair dues. But it's not being conflated with public health in the same way as it was when it was all done by Public Health England. So I think that's a small but good thing. Presumably, let's face it, it's going to be all the same people. I mean, Duncan Selby's gone off to some well-paid job advising the Department of Health. Duncan Selby was the CEO of Public Health England. But I'd be surprised if there's any more personnel changes than that. Which, from the point of view of vaping, is good, because Public Health England has always been sound on vaping. They do very good reports every year, which they outsource to King's College and get some genuine experts writing about it. But the rest of the stuff, as we've discussed many times, this podcast has been very stupid and negative, and it's rightly got itself a reputation for ridiculous ideas. I think the government has an opportunity to drop a lot of this stuff now, the food reformulation in particular, Public Health England was spearheading. Whether it will or not, I don't know, but it's a good opportunity to do so. The Department of Health is already starting to drop various bits from the obesity strategy as they actually look at the detail and just realize this isn't going to work. We can't ban companies from advertising wedding cakes on every digital platform ever again, which is what's been proposed. So allegedly the online food advertising ban's been dropped, which is great. They need to do the same thing with the TV advertising ban. They've watered down the mandatory calorie counts in the out-of-home sector. So it's just going to be like McDonald's and Starbucks and places that already have calorie counts. Only businesses with more than 250 employees, I think. So that's good. So a lot of this stuff is just disintegrating on contact with reality, as it always had to do. And there might not be that much left of it by the end. But the final point is that the Office for Health Promotion is now officially part of the Department of Health. It doesn't even have, you know, ostensible autonomy. It is just the government. It's openly an arm of the government. So I don't think it's going to be able to engage in the same kind of in-house lobbying as Public Health England did. You know, Public Health England was the biggest sock puppet of all, because it was officially, it was all autonomous. And so it could make these recommendations and it could propose things that the government had already rejected. And I don't see how the Department of Health can do that. I don't see how it can go, we must have minimum pricing and the government is being irresponsible if it doesn't bring in, if the government has said, no, we don't want to do minimum pricing. You know, that aspect of it, I think, might be positive. But other than that, I think it's going to be, you know, here comes a new boss, same as the old boss. Probably.
Claire, where do you think we're heading with all this?
Yeah, delighted to see the end of Public Health England. And that latter point that you made, Chris, is important, because I do think they have to own it now. I mean, it is the Department of Health, and anything they say, we can hold them to account. You know, and there was always that sort of sense of, oh, we're only listening to Public Health England, as though they were a kind of slightly separate group. And now we all know. You know, one of the things that is weird, you know, I spoke earlier about the way COVID had been used opportunistically to push certain things. And it has been fascinating that, you know, there you are facing a proper pandemic, and then people will say, and this is why you shouldn't drink wine. And you think, well, what else are you going to bloody do? You locked it. You know what I mean? You know, it's bad for you. Or, and, you know, there's been various attempts at doing the odd bit of lifestyle. And the obesity stuff has been very confusing, to say the least. I mean, a lot of people have fallen for that, by the way. But, you know, a lot of people think obesity has been one of the big factors in COVID. And so that's kind of quite popularly understood. But there's been, I thought the lifestyle stuff would go. I remember thinking about work you'd done, Chris, because I suddenly thought, oh, isn't it weird? We're having a pandemic. Whereas for the last 10 years, we've been hearing about pandemics in drinking, in binge drinking, pandemics in sugar eating. I mean, they always used to use these kind of big viral images. And you realize they couldn't get away with that anymore because this was a real pandemic. And I did think it might mean the end of the lifestyle pandemic analogy being used. Bit depressing, therefore, to see that they say, now that we're through COVID, we understand the importance of lifestyle to fighting off things like pandemics in the future. And they just glibly mention obesity, alcohol, and smoking. I mean, smoking really made me laugh because, as we know, one of the things that rather embarrassingly happened for everybody during this pandemic was that a sort of recognition, well, all smokers aren't disproportionately high numbers of people dying of coronavirus, even though it looked like the kind of thing that you would be the first ones to go. So what, change of name, same bosses, but I think the biggest problem, if you want, for those of us who worry about the misuse of public health, regardless of a name change, is that we have just given up all of our freedoms in the name of public health. Health has become the new basis of virtue. And one of the most brilliant things you wrote, Chris, I mean, I don't mean to be flattering you because there's lots of things I could criticize you for, but you wrote a brilliant thing for Spite once about kind of whether health should be the outcome of life. You know what I mean? It was a longer essay for Spike, which I quote all the time, where you said, do I want to be this pristine, healthy person? Is that my nirvana? Is that what everybody wants? And it's assumed that that's what a good citizen is. And I think that that has become embedded into the narrative of what makes a good citizen far more now than even when public health wanted it to be that. And so therefore, regardless of getting rid of one agency, glad to see the advertising thing watered down, glad to see Iron Brew full of sugar and saying, you know, yes, buy it if you want, you know, we're not going to play this game. But I'm sadly pessimistic about the fact that health and being safe in terms of our health is still going to be the dominant narrative of politics for the next few years because of COVID.
And Chris, I know you wanted to touch on some of the more good news stories. You've touched on a few of them there, but is there any more that you want to fill us in on? Claire referenced the return of Iron Brew, even more sugary than beforehand. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the only good news story, to be fair. But we take these victories where we can, you know, so let's make the most of them. This is the 1901 Iron Brew. You may recall AG Barr, the makers of Iron Brew, came up with what some people would describe as a Shaggy Dog story. Maybe it was true, I don't know. But one of the, you know, the great grandson of AG Barr supposedly was going around the offices and found this dusty tome. And when he opened it up, he found the original recipe for Iron Brew. And it would be a shame not to share this recipe with the Scottish people because it's part of their heritage, you know. And it happens to have even more sugar than the type of Iron Brew that they just discontinued and had seen their share price plummet by 40% as a result. So they brought it back as a limited edition. And then a few days ago or last week, they said, actually, we're going to keep it permanent. Would you believe? I haven't tried it yet, though. I'd like to get my hands on some. It's quite hard to get down here on the South Coast. But maybe when we all meet up again and can do this in person, we can have a tasting session.
Sounds like a great idea. Chris, Claire, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated.